Chapter 7. The Submission to Science. At the heart of science is an essential balance between two seemingly contradictory attitudes, an openness to new ideas, no matter how bizarre or counterintuitive they may be, and the most skeptical scrutiny of all ideas, old and new. This is how deep truths are winnowed from deep nonsense. Carl Sagan. After the Cleveland Clinic, the National Cancer Institute, and the Whittemore Peterson Institute signed the Confidentiality and Collaborative Research Agreement on Saturday, January 24, 2009, to isolate the XMRV retrovirus from humans for the very first time, and demonstrate its association with MECFS, Mikovits quickly jotted off an email to her lab technician, Katie Hagen. When the word contamination later became such a hot-button issue, the email was an important record of Mikovits's thought process, as she briefed Katie on how to properly decontaminate the lab for upcoming experiments. All of the signatories understood the momentousness of what they were embarking on. They were on the hunt to isolate a new human retrovirus of unknown pathogenic potential. The implications could be even further reaching than the AIDS epidemic. If they succeeded, their findings might create a revolution in thinking about the role retroviruses play in human health. Most virology research dollars were spent hunting visible killer viruses, such as Ebola, West Nile virus, and bird flu. But what if such conspicuous targets were only part of the story? Scientists had been focused for over a century on viruses that brought obvious mayhem and death to society. But what about viruses that might be incapacitants, silently stealing the health of victims? As Michael Spector wrote in The New Yorker, "Nothing, not even the plague, has posed a more persistent threat to humanity than viral diseases. Yellow fever, measles, and smallpox have been causing epidemics for thousands of years." Those viruses were highly infectious, yet their impact was limited by their ferocity. A virus may destroy an entire culture, but if we die, it dies too. Only retroviruses, which reverse the usual flow of genetic code from DNA to RNA, are capable of that. If a retrovirus could lower the defenses of the immune system, ushering in a host of pathogens that in turn caused complex damage, the invasion of the body snatchers scenario became overwhelming. MECFS patients sometimes called themselves the living dead. Though other diseases had caused freakish disruptions of sleep, such as African sleeping sickness, fatal familial insomnia, there were few conditions that matched the twilight reality of MECFS that could linger for decades. Yes, patients remained alive, but barely. Mikovits kept thinking of Dr. Mark Lovelace's statement that an MECFS patient feels every day about the same as an AIDS patient feels 2 months before death, or Dr. Nancy Klimas's declaration that her AIDS patients were hale and hearty compared to her MECFS patients. "Many of my CFS patients, on the other hand, are terribly ill and unable to work or participate in the care of their families," Klimas wrote in a New York Times blog. Mikovits and her team now had a propulsive plan. Once they had meticulously done their research, they would submit their article to the most prestigious scientific journal in the world, Science. Then the evidence would cross into the global sphere for other scientists to grab the baton. With a clearer grasp of pathophysiology, they could finally work on therapeutics for the disease. But they had to be exacting. From the beginning, they must eliminate every possible source of contamination. She had learned from Frank Rossetti and her work with HTLV-1 and HIV-1, when isolating a new human retrovirus and attempting to associate it with a disease, contamination was the foremost threat. She kept this as her highest priority. In her email to Katie Hagen, Mikovits detailed what she had learned to be the possible sources of contamination after more than 2 decades of work with human retroviruses. She told Katie to wipe down everything in the lab with bleach, change HEPA filters, empty all incubators of cultured cells, also no cultures in the laboratory but primary patient culture, and autoclave the glassware, instruments, and where possible, reagents. An autoclave sterilizes lab equipment in high-pressure saturated steam at temperatures above 400 degrees Fahrenheit for about 15 to 20 minutes. Katie methodically went through the decontamination procedures and then carefully taped the email from Mikovits into her notebook on January 25, 2009. These were standard procedures when working with retroviruses. But of course, HIV had spawned a whole generation of ever-increasing caution. When Mikovits returned a few days later, she pulled out official HIV decontamination protocols and made sure those were carefully followed in the lab as well. Since the WPI building was still under construction, they had been working in temporary lab space. Room 401 of the Applied Research Facility at the University of Nevada, Reno. Keeping the research confined to a single laboratory lessened the possibility of contamination. Mikovits flashed back to her first science job, when she was a protein chemist at the National Cancer Institute's fermentation program, and how, in her opinion, there had been lax safety procedures during the first growth of HTLV retrovirus in large-scale fermenters that were something like the steel tanks in today's microbreweries. The questions about XMRV were the same as they had been about HTLV in the early fermentation lab, and much more important 2 years later as they isolated HIV in Rossetti's lab. How infectious was the virus? How stable was it? Nobody knew the answers with XMRV, so it was crucial to proceed as cautiously as possible. They also had to determine what other parties should sign the confidentiality agreement and participate so the research could go forward, but keep the team limited to a minimal number due to the project's riskiness. Mikovits added Katie Hagen and Max Post as signatories. Frank Rossetti added 2 of his research associates. At Bob Silverman's lab, J. Dip Dasgupta was added because he would do the genetic sequencing of the virus. Mikovits then contacted Debbie, a nurse who had worked at Peterson's office. Besides being a nurse, Debbie was a skilled phlebotomist. Mikovits assigned Debbie to draw blood, consent people into studies, coordinate patients, and keep clinical data in order. Because the WPI had yet to be awarded its first NIH grant, Debbie could only be salaried as a part-time employee, and Mikovits was limited in assistance to students and a single postdoc, Lombardi. One of Debbie's first duties was to draw the blood of everybody at the lab to see if they had been exposed to or infected by XMRV. This blood work would establish a baseline for the lab workers and allow protection of the staff from unknown risks. If any of them already carried the retrovirus, it could compromise the integrity of the research, and they would have to be dismissed since the workers themselves could bring contamination. A consequence of this confidential study was that relatively few people could be even aware of its existence. The graduate students running experiments in Room 401 were also a concern. If they were not directly involved in Project X, as it came to be known, they still had to be protected from exposure because of the shared facilities. Mikovits had to encourage them to finish up their projects, move them to another lab, or simply shut them down and shuffle them out without offering an explanation. She knew that being brusque and secretive about Project X was likely to generate hard feelings, especially as it would be out of character for her. But those were the options. For many reasons, she decided that the lab in Applied Research Facility, ARF, Room 401, would only be used for work with patient blood samples, and that no virus would be grown there. Lombardi would grow the virus in a separate lab at Viral Immune Pathology, VIPDX, a distinct company purchased as Arnazel Enzyme Deficiency Lab, RED, Labs, from Dr. Kenny DeMerler in 2004 by the Whittemores in order to bring to market any diagnostic tests or therapeutic treatments that might be developed for ME/CFS. Even though the WPI still didn't have its own laboratories, they would pour copious resources into the XMRV project. The project was not even on Mikovits's original list presented to her scientific advisory board just a few months earlier. The risks were incredibly high, the atmosphere necessarily covert. But Silverman and Rossetti thought the preliminary data was so compelling and the benefits for the patients so potentially dramatic that they just had to go all in. In a town of cheap slot machines and occasional windfalls, Mikovits and her team were ready to roll the dice. Mikovits was routinely up at 5 a.m., clutching a cup of coffee, and on the phone with Frank Rossetti, who had returned to the NCI in Frederick, Maryland. They laid out plans for the critical experiments they needed to perform, determined who would do what, figured out what samples from the repository were important, and strategized how to move the daunting tasks forward. Mikovits spent substantial time writing up the plans with Katie Hagen, who had risen toward the top of the pack of research associates and students. Katie was focused and thorough, and Mikovits saw a vision of herself as a young researcher when Rossetti had noticed her potential. Although it was not one of the four methods they would eventually use to test for the presence of the virus, Mikovits knew it was important to show that XMRV had a natural history of infection in humans by isolating virus from patients and passing it into other cells. Previously, all of the work on XMRV biology had been done using an infectious molecular clone, which was constructed from partial XMRV sequences from RNA isolated from tissues from prostate cancer patients. One way to obtain this evidence was an electron micrograph picture of XMRV, preferably an image of the particle budding from a cell. This could be compelling evidence the virus was actually replicating and infecting other cells. To isolate XMRV from a single human, then use it to infect white blood cells repeatedly, would prove that XMRV was the first member of the third known infectious human retrovirus family. Electron micrograph pictures had proved solid evidence with other retroviruses. Poise and Rossetti presented one with the isolation of HTLV-1, and Montagnier obtained an electron micrograph image of the HIV retrovirus that became a central piece of evidence in convincing the scientific community that HIV was a human infection. Montagnier brandished the electron micrograph picture to doubters and decriers. The image was pretty indisputable, a vivid depiction of something previously unknown to science. However, there was no electron microscope available for use in the vast but sparsely populated state of Nevada. Most science students across the world have peered into a regular light microscope and seen cells, so they have an appreciation for the small size of a typical cell. They can learn to identify the cell wall, the protoplasm, maybe even the nucleus. But a virus is typically about a million times smaller than the cells they infect, so without much more magnified imaging, the virus is guesswork, almost phantasmal to students trying to comprehend it. The virus contains a relatively small amount of genetic information, leading to the question posed in the last chapter. Is a virus a living thing, or more like a parasitic entity? Some who argue a virus lives say that the ability to reproduce is the hallmark of a living thing. Others claim viruses are not alive since they lack reproductive machinery and must hijack cells to propagate. Modern virus hunting rarely includes electron microscopy, but relies primarily on molecular genetic sequence data. But to Mikovits, the appeal of an electron micrograph picture of the suspected virus was undeniable. A traditional expression in science states, "Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence." Having a vivid picture for people to see, rather than just a dry sequence of numbers on a page, would go a long way. Mikovits was fortunate enough to have a friend back at the NCI who ran the NCI's electron microscopy facility. He was the scientist who took the electron micrographs that proved the retrovirus Gallo claimed as his HIV retrovirus had actually been taken from Luc Montagnier's samples. The WPI would have to pay for the work to be done, but the Whittemores could make it happen. It would take a great deal of work on the part of Mikovits and Hagen to get samples ready for electron microscopy, but Mikovits felt it was of critical importance. The work was done in a biosafety level 3 lab at UNR, and Mikovits prepared to teach Hagen the procedure to get the samples ready. Cells needed to be cultured and then pelleted by high-speed centrifugation, first separating virus in the supernatant from cells and cellular debris. Finally, the viral particle containing supernatant had to be concentrated at very high-speed ultra-centrifugation and the virus pellet stabilized. A virus is actually composed of two parts, an outer protein shell called a capsid and an inner core, which is composed of either DNA or RNA. A virus looks like an M&M candy, with a hard outer candy shell and a chocolate or peanut interior. Enveloped virus had a lipid-containing membrane called a viral envelope. The outer layer of the virus can have a different arrangement of viral and cellular proteins, which it gets while budding from the cell, which bind to cell surface receptors that allow it to enter into various cells. These viral protein molecules have also been found to provoke many of the body's immune responses. Some researchers have speculated that many autoimmune diseases are the result of the body reacting to the envelope proteins, the hard candy shell of certain viruses, rather than an infectious process. Much of the later debate about XMRV would revolve around this point. But with the M&M analogy, the chocolate, peanut, or even more recently, pretzel, interior of a virus has caused the greatest amount of debate. In what scientists consider a replication-competent virus, there would be a shell and an inner core with a complete genetic sequence. But defective viruses have only a protein shell and a partial genetic sequence inside, and need helper viruses to spread. The scientific community has typically responded that if a virus does not contain a complete interior genetic sequence, it should not be considered a dangerous microorganism. It's like a Tin Man without a heart or a scarecrow without a brain. Others, including Dr. Sandra Rossetti, the head of the retroviral pathogenesis section of the NCI, have advocated for a long time that science needs to take a closer look at the disease-causing potential of the protein shells of these viruses. Sandra Rossetti had published extensively on the spleen focus-forming virus, SFFV, a replication-defective retrovirus that nonetheless becomes very pathogenic in susceptible strains of mice. What Mikovits learned from Sandra Rossetti was later invaluable in the investigation of XMRV. For the time being, when Mikovits and Hagen were finally able to obtain a pellet from the ultracentrifugation, it was composed of almost pure virions. Once the work was completed, the samples traveled to her friend at the NCI, who produced 6 electron micrograph pictures. Even looking like colorful but unearthly creatures, the images were as clear as anything that Montagnier had shown more than a quarter of a century earlier in the HIV investigation. The evidence was becoming even stronger that they were on the trail of a new human retrovirus. This was a critical first step. Now they had to move forward to show the virus was infectious and transmissible. This could be the first member of the third family of human infectious retroviruses. Mikovits was simply looking for some evidence of the XMRV retrovirus in patient blood samples. GAG is the name given to one of the 3 major proteins that are encoded within the genome of a retrovirus. Each retrovirus has a specific GAG sequence, almost like a fingerprint, so once a researcher has identified the GAG sequence, she should have a pretty good idea of the identity of the retrovirus. Since all retroviruses require the machinery of a cell to replicate, they lie dormant in cells until a signal is received that allow them to replicate to a detectable level. Transmitting the virus from the patient's white blood cells or plasma into the LNCAP cell line, an immortalized line derived from a lymph node metastasis from a 62-year-old prostate cancer patient, appeared to make the virus replicate like crazy. Mikovits knew that LNCAP was responsive to hormones and cytokines, inflammatory molecules, and in fact turned out to be the single best cell line in which to grow gamma retroviruses. Importantly, it had never been cultured with mouse cells lines or passed through mouse tissues. It was a stroke of good luck, allowing them to biologically amplify low levels of virus from a small number of white blood cells or a minimal amount of plasma so that it could be detected. She could use this indicator cell line with those samples they had painstakingly prepared for more than 2 years from Peterson's patients and those with abnormal immune responses. Another necessary step was to show which immune cells harbored the new gamma retrovirus. Were they T cells and monocytes, as was the case in HTLV or HIV, or were there different reservoirs of infection? Could the retrovirus be transmitted cell-free, by virus floating free in plasma, like HIV, or did transmission require cell-to-cell contact, with the virus contained within cells, like HTLV-1? They were all key questions that a paper on the first isolation of a new human retrovirus should answer to be fully credible. A key proof that the XMRV isolated from the patient samples was not due to contamination involved looking for the presence of antibodies to XMRV in the blood of patients. In most viral infections, this was a simple and straightforward way of looking for evidence of past or current viral activity. But the question remained whether this was a reasonable way to search for evidence of a virus that had not previously been isolated from humans. In the first publication for the isolation of HTLV and HIV, this had been considered beyond the scope of the first paper. Mikovits and her team focused instead on proving XMRV isolates from humans with ME/CFS were infectious and transmissible. They also attempted to confirm Silverman's finding showing that XMRV infections were limited to individuals with a specific genetic polymorphism in the R-nasal gene, that of R462Q, a single nucleotide change that essentially rendered the antiviral enzyme inactive. Many of the most deadly viruses, such as Ebola, seem to cause the greatest damage in those individuals whose systems did not mount an antibody response. The immune system was like a sickly guard dog, sleeping through the invasion. It was reasonable to think the most severely infected patients with the virus would show no antibodies at all to the virus. That was why they were sick, as they could not fight it off. By contrast, the healthiest of the ME/CFS patients, or those with some degree of recovery, would show the highest antibody response. Focusing on whether the isolates from XMRV-infected individuals were infectious and transmissible were old-school, time-consuming methods of finding a virus, but Mikovits preferred them. Some of the more technologically advanced methods, like the viral array chip technologies, suffered limitations, such as the failure to load the proper sequence into the chip. If the technology wasn't right, the answers wouldn't be either. Garbage in, garbage out, as the computer programmers like to say. An additional safeguard was to keep the various parts of the study separate so that nobody could later question whether there had been inadvertent contamination. Post was doing his part of the work at a lab in the agriculture building, a place that had never grown human or mouse cultures. Hagen was working at the Biosafety 3 lab. Lombardi was working at the private VIPDX lab, which was about 10 miles away from the University of Nevada, Reno campus, and patient material was all confined to the Mikovits Research Lab, located at the Applied Research Facility, Room 401. Among their small group of junior researchers, Lombardi, the former stockbroker who had only a year earlier received his doctorate in protein chemistry, would take a leading position. Mikovits assigned Lombardi to work on the immunological aspects of the paper, mainly whether the R-nasal enzyme deficiency, the natural killer cell markers, or any other immune indicators were correlated with XMRV infection. While Mikovits and her team of young researchers were working on their secret project, Mikovits also had other important tasks at hand. The International Association of Chronic Fatigue Syndrome, IACFS, was meeting from March 12th through 15th, 2009 in Reno, and the WPI was gearing up to host it at the Peppermill Resort, which had recently finished its $400 million renovation. Mikovits and her team submitted four papers for presentation at the meeting. The Sino family, part owners of the Peppermill, rolled out the red carpet for scientists not accustomed to the casino lifestyle. Those attending the conference got reduced room rates, some with jaw-dropping views of the snow-capped Sierra Nevada mountains and the city lights of Reno, access to 10 of Reno's finest restaurants right there at the Peppermill, and a space to relax at the Spa Toscano, a full-service salon where one could relax with a Swedish or deep-tissue massage. The program promised the latest advances in virology, genetics, pediatrics, brain functioning, epidemiology, treatment, and assessment, and Mikovits focused on welcoming the speakers and hosting the conference. For their keynote speaker, they had Dr. John Kitzhaber, the former two-term governor of Oregon, whose wife suffered from ME/CFS. There were presentations on behavioral assessment of ME/CFS patients, alternative medical treatments, use of interferon, active HHV6, HHV7, Epstein-Barr virus, cytomegalovirus, and even an association between ME/CFS and mitochondrial dysfunction. Of the four talks being presented by Mikovits and her team, two gave her pause. One that she was scheduled to give, Identification of Differentially Expressed Viruses in American CFS Patients with a Custom Mammalian Virus Microarray, and one by her postdoctoral fellow Lombardi, entitled Serum Cytokine and Chemokine Profiles of Individuals with ME/CFS Distinguish Unique Subgroups Among Patient Populations. There were many sharp minds at the conference. One attendee was Dr. Maureen Hansen of Cornell University, who had been studying ME/CFS ever since her close relative had come down with it. As Hansen later recalled, at the meeting, she, Mikovits, talked about using a microarray for viruses in chronic fatigue syndrome, and I had been thinking of doing the very same experiment myself. So I was glad to see that somebody else had already done it, and people were trying to find out if viruses were present. Mikovits was afraid that if anybody was really paying attention to the two talks from her group, they might sleuth out that someone was on the trail of a retrovirus. The talks could blow their cover, but they were only 10 minutes long. So, Mikovits was careful with the data shown in the slides so they wouldn't scream out retrovirus to somebody who really knew the science. But the conference did not expose them. Mikovits was pleased the talk she presented on behalf of her NCI colleague and the talk by colleague and UNR epidemiologist Julie Smith Gagan were noted in Harvard Professor Komaroff's summary as among the most intriguing at the conference. There were some rumors buzzing around the conference of a new virus isolation, but the research team was tight-lipped and their data was preliminary. If attendees later felt they had been misled by the attenuated talks, well, the information would break with a bang in a couple months. The data was just too sensitive to be prematurely released. As the team moved ahead, however, there were a few tiny fissures in the unity of the project. When Mikovits had returned from the earlier San Diego conference and discussed the suspicions of a retrovirus with the Whittemores, they all agreed to bring Peterson in on the research. He would be integral to choosing the patients most likely to harbor the virus, and Mikovits was concerned that they might be constrained if they were unable to obtain fresh patient blood. The Whittemores asked Peterson to sign the confidentiality agreement. He asked what it was about, but the Whittemores said they would tell him after he signed it. He wanted his lawyer to take a look. This reasonable volley back and forth somehow began the deterioration of the relationship with Peterson, but the reasons were never clear to Mikovits. Mostly, the process was efficient and congenial, as well as exciting. Every Wednesday, there was a meeting at the luxurious offices at the Red Hawk Resort with Annette, Harvey, Mikovits, Peterson, and Mike Hillerby, who was one of the bosses at the Wingfield, Nevada holding company. They discussed what was not covered by the confidentiality agreement, and only that, carefully avoiding any mention of the details of their secret project, the one named Project X in their computer folders now. Harvey would often take Peterson aside and tell him that the confidentiality agreement needed to be signed, because he had an important matter to discuss. But even the king of the legislature could not get through to the doctor who had landed at ground zero of the modern epidemic of ME/CFS. Nobody knew why. Silverman also threw a wrench into the works. In early April of 2009, Mikovits contacted Silverman and asked, "Okay, you said you've done this in hundreds of samples. Can you provide the peripheral blood mononuclear cells, the blood data, For those where you found XMRV negative for everybody except those with the R462Q variation? The R462Q variation was the genetic aberration that Silverman credited with causing the crippling defect in the RNase-L antiviral defense enzyme. Mikovits wanted those data from blood rather than tissue, since they were using blood samples from the ME/CFS patients, and XMRV had never been isolated from the prostate cancer patient's tissue or blood. They were trying to determine if the R462Q variation correlated to evidence of XMRV in blood, and thus to the RNase-L defect, and needed to make this comparison using blood instead of tissue. Silverman replied, "Oh, we never looked in blood." The control samples he had done were of prostate tissue for people who either didn't have prostate cancer but had resections for things like benign hyperplasia, or from other tissue surrounding the diseased area, and thus tissue samples were what was available. This revelation injected an unanticipated degree of uncertainty into the XMRV investigation. It was clear that Silverman could identify the XMRV virus in tissue, but it might be another thing entirely to locate the virus in blood. This was in part due to the problem of viral latency, the ability of a virus to hide in certain organs and not be detectable in the bloodstream. This was a dilemma that kept virologists awake at night. Does a negative viral test based on a blood sample really mean the patient is negative? Could the virus be latent and inactivated in organs and tissue, in the DNA, as theorized by Cheney? Could a relatively low amount of viral activity cause symptoms in the patient, but not otherwise leave traces in the blood? If the virus was in some way modulating the immune response to ensure its survival, it became much more complex, stealth, and puzzling. So Mikovits, just about a month out from submitting the paper, suddenly had her back against the wall. While Mikovits and Rossetti had looked at the blood of healthy people, the non-contact controls for viral expression, they had never looked at the much higher number of samples needed to be examined for a genetic mutation like RNase-L R462Q. She had to find more healthy blood donors since Silverman could not offer blood samples. Fortunately, the cytokine paper the Mikovits team had started in 2007 yielded an unexpected bonus. In preparation for the study, they had acquired a number of normal blood samples. The samples had been collected by a UNR researcher and a physician in Reno in the course of a study to examine normal immune responses in women. It was Mikovits's good fortune that the samples had been perfectly prepared for her intended use. The samples contained both plasma and DNA and a lot of flow cytometry data, which would allow them to look at populations of natural killer cells and differences in lymphocyte populations. All they had to do was take the DNA and plasma for XMRV PCR and serology and do co-cultures with LNCAP and RNase-L genetic studies. Other controls were also tested blindly in Frank Rossetti's lab at the National Cancer Institute. He was also able to get fresh controls through the National Institutes of Health, who were always collecting samples as part of their ongoing mission of protecting public health. In addition to the samples from the cytokine study, the WPI was able to purchase 100 frozen samples from a paternity testing lab in Nevada. The paternity samples offered an advantage in that they were age and sex matched according to geographical locations, which could be identified by their zip codes. One of the concerns in terms of backlash was that people might make the mistaken assumption that the control samples were from those who might have been linked to the Lake Tahoe outbreak of 1984 and 1985. The mix of samples from around the United States with a concentration in Nevada, as well as the controls Frank Rossetti was receiving through the NIH, should make it clear the team was looking at the prevalence of the virus in the general population. They combined the results from controls for the Nevada group, which was about 4% positive for XMRV, and the results from Frank Rossetti's group at the NCI, which were close to 3.5%. The control group eventually included 320 subjects who had no history of ME/CFS. 12 of the controls were positive for the XMRV retrovirus, an infection rate of 3.75%. If those numbers could be extrapolated to the U.S. population, it meant that somewhere between 10 to 12 million Americans were infected with the virus. 12 million people would equal close to the total 2012 populations of New York City, 8.337 million, and Los Angeles, 3.858 million, combined. Obviously a devastating number. The comparison of ME/CFS fatigue to an atom bomb suddenly seemed eerily apt, and not just because of how the patients felt. It was as if a sneak attack had been launched against the American public, and even now they didn't see the smoking wreckage. Before they could finish up their manuscript and send it off, one event took precedence over all other things, a soiree that every member of the WPI was expected to attend, the Andrea Whittemore wedding. Andrea Whittemore and Brian Goad said their vows on April 25, 2009, in Reno. It was a quintessentially lavish Whittemore affair, displaying the wealth, political influence, and familial closeness that led Mikovits to later dub them the Kennedys of Nevada. The wedding was slated for 11 o'clock at the historic Trinity Episcopal Church on the banks of the Truckee River that twisted through downtown Reno. Frank and Sandy Rossetti flew out for the wedding, and the Whittemores put them up at their luxury 12th-floor condominium at the Palladio, a swanky downtown development. The unit had western views, which took in not only the sunset over the Carson Range, whose peaks reached more than 5,000 feet into the sky, but a section of the Truckee River and the city of Reno. Mikovits's condominium was just a block away. The Rossettis were also there to work on the final sections of the paper with Mikovits. Sandy Rossetti's expertise in mouse retroviruses and the protein envelope were of critical importance. The wedding was on a dazzling, sun-dappled April day, typical for Reno. Pleasant and bright, but not too hot. The wedding party included many members of the large Whittemore family. The church's old-fashioned pipe organ added to the grandness of the space, and once Mikovits showed up with her group, there were at least 200 people seated. She and David slid into a pew with Frank and Sandy Rossetti, as well as Katie Hagen and her parents. Katie's father was Judge David Hagen, and her mother Peggy was one of Annette Whittemore's best friends. The service, traditionally Episcopalian, reminded Mikovits of her girlhood Catholicism, and she was delighted to see Andrea, the woman who lost much of her girlhood to a ravaging disease, have this opportunity. The wedding ended at just past noon, but the reception wasn't scheduled until 6, giving Andrea time to recuperate a little before her next public showing. Along with David, Frank, and Sandy, and Katie and her parents, their group headed over to the Silver Peak for some lunch and drinks. When the meal was over, Judy and David went with Frank and Sandy to the Whittemore condominium at the Palladio and spent a few hours chatting about the remaining issues in the paper. The reception at the Peppermill Casino gathered together all the usual political dignitaries. But the highlight of Andrea's wedding reception was, without a doubt, the father-daughter dance. Pictures of Andrea's porcelain skin and slightly forced smile with a nasal oxygen cannula were later featured in the New York Times, but for now, the dance floor cleared to a lighted silence, and then Big Harvey took the floor with his pale, delicate daughter, and they floated around to the music. Unbeknownst to Mikovits, and probably most of the guests, beneath the surface of the celebration were broiling issues that threatened to destroy the Whittemore Empire and the accomplishments of the WPI. In a lawsuit filed on January 27, 2012, by their business partners in the Wingfield Nevada Group Holding Company, the Cinos alleged that prior to Andrea's wedding, Harvey had illegally obtained a $44 million loan and spent it all in 15 months' time. According to the lawsuit, Harvey had also made a confession. As admitted in his confession, Whittemore lied to the Cinos when he represented to them that he would use his personal funds toward capital contributions to Wingfield. To the contrary, Whittemore admitted in his confession that he used bank proceeds for lifestyle choices and to make other investments. It also alleged that Harvey did not even have enough money to pay for his daughter's wedding. He put the wedding expenses on the Cino and Wingfield tab. One such event was his daughter's wedding, which included five-star food and wine tastings, bridal showers, and a rehearsal dinner leading up to the wedding. These events included the purchase of tuxedo uniforms for Red Hawk waitstaff, special China dinnerware named after his daughter, special custom lighting, exterior and interior alterations to Red Hawk premises, and many other purchased items and extraordinary costs and expenses, which, except for a meager $10,000 paid by Whittemore, were all paid for by Wingfield at Whittemore's direction. Wingfield's expense for the affair totaled approximately $200,000, which was charged to Wingfield without the Cinos' knowledge, approval, or consent. Harvey was already legendary in Nevada as King of the Legislature, a Power Ranger, and a close confidant of the Senate Majority Leader of the United States Senate. But according to the Cino lawsuit, in 2009, he barely had $10,000 to contribute to his daughter's wedding. Mikovits, her team at the WPI, and her collaborators at the NCI and the Cleveland Clinic had no idea that the vaunted Whittemore real estate empire was looking more and more like a house of cards. On the afternoon of May 6, 2009, Mikovits emailed the Science article showing an association between the XMRV retrovirus and patients with CFS, along with the accompanying figures. April and early May of 2009 were consumed with the furious writing and revision of the paper. The article went through a dozen revisions, with Silverman, Mikovits, Rossetti, and the co-authors all rewriting various parts until it was finally in impeccable shape. To celebrate the victorious completion of the edits, Mikovits took her small team out for dinner. Mikovits couldn't help but notice how weary everybody looked. They had worked feverishly over the past 4 months, and though their faces might not show it, they had reason to be deeply proud. Science was supposed to respond within 30 days of the submission, so for the first few days, Mikovits tried to block thoughts of the paper out of her mind. In the review process, the journal would likely request additional items. Even if they didn't, there were still aspects of the project to complete. She would take a breather, relax a bit, and then plunge back into the work that had been put on hold after the meeting of the International Association for Chronic Fatigue Syndrome the past March. The Invest in ME meeting was at the end of May. It was one of Mikovits's favorites, and she had to prepare her talk on immunology and the viral microarray. She was so hopeful that she might have an answer from science by the meeting that her last slide was an electron micrograph of XMRV. At the conference, Hillary Johnson delivered an electrifying speech called The Why, about the systemic ostracizing of ME/CFS patients, stating, "Hate speech incites acts of discrimination against the victims of such speech. Think of all that is denied ME patients as a result of being characterized as malingerers, attention seekers, neurotic and emotionally weak, or as David Bell says, nutballs and fruitcakes. How did the Soviet Union discredit its dissidents? It called them mentally ill. Labeling ME a psychiatric disorder is a political act, a form of social violence." It seemed to underscore the timeliness of Mikovits's research that would hopefully end tactics to discredit the sufferers. She was so moved by Johnson's speech that she called Frank Rossetti at a late hour and begged him to let her reveal the secret of the retrovirus. He reminded her how important it was to have the paper published first. Mikovits remembered the January day 6 months earlier when she and Lombardi had showed the preliminary data to Silverman and Rossetti, and Silverman had exclaimed, "This will change everything for the patients." On the way back to Reno, she stopped in Frederick, Maryland to visit family and work on the ongoing collaborations with Frank Rossetti and her former National Cancer Institute colleagues. They anticipated one of the questions a reviewer might ask was, "If your original hypothesis was based on the Arnazel R462Q-SNP correlation in the prostate cancer patients, and the Arnazel deficiency in ME/CFS patients, did you find the R462Q-SNP correlation of the Arnazel gene in ME/CFS patients?" They wanted to prepare for this essential question. Mikovits was concerned because the work had seemed beyond the reach of the WPI's limited resources. She knew the experts in these types of genetic analyses were Drs. Michael Dean and Bert Gold at the NCI, so she invited them into the project. Curiously, their team did not find an association between the Arnazel genetic variation and patients with ME/CFS. It was still true, per earlier research, that the Arnazel antiviral defense enzyme was working poorly in patients with ME/CFS. But they didn't know which genetic variation was causing it, or whether the faulty enzyme might be caused by something else altogether. As frustrating as this development was, these little hiccups commonly happened in research. The finding was unexpected, and something of a black eye for Bob Silverman, whose original hypothesis now appeared in jeopardy. What appeared to be true one day might be disproven the next. But that was the nature of science. On Thursday, June 4, 2009, the editor of Science sent out the journal's review of the paper. On Thursday, June 4, 2009, the editor of Science sent out the journal's review of the paper. Mikovits was in Frank Rossetti's office when the email arrived, and the two of them quickly raced through it. The journal was intrigued by the findings, but had a number of reservations about the work. There were concerns about the possibility of contamination, the genetic background of the patients, whether the virus might be a cofactor, and whether the finding might be a PCR false positive. Mikovits and Rossetti read through the comments of the referees, and perhaps because they felt too close to the original work, they sent a copy of the comments to a colleague and WPI advisor. The colleague was much more optimistic than Mikovits and Rossetti had been about the comments. "You're in," he wrote back enthusiastically, noting the objections were easily answerable and the additional research could be completed in a fairly brief period of time. The key was showing an immune response, which would eliminate the possibility of contamination. Mikovits dove back into the research, adding a former student and brilliant young scientist who could develop the phylogenetic tree of XMRV. The phylogenetic tree would show the evolutionary relationship between XMRV and its closest viral cousins. Science asked for the immune response, and Silverman would say, "I hope you can find one, an immune response, because Abbott Labs cannot." Rossetti would confirm this statement when he attended the retrovirology conference in Brazil over the 4th of July holiday, and said Abbott had not been able to find an antibody in more than 1,000 blood samples. By July 12, 2009, Mikovits felt the manuscript was ready to be resubmitted. In the letter, she wrote, "All of the referees' concerns have been addressed with new data. As a result, we feel our new data strengthens the conclusions that the novel human retrovirus, XMRV, is present in most patients with chronic fatigue syndrome, CFS. We show that XMRV detected in humans is not a lab contaminant by 1. Providing a phylogenetic tree relating all human and mouse XMRV and XMRV sequences as requested by reviewer number 1, supplemental figure 2, showing that XMRV strains identified in this study and in the original report on XMRV cluster as a group separate from XMRV. 2, demonstrating the presence of circulating antibody to XMRV ENV protein, the envelope or protein shell of the virus, plasma, as requested by advisor A, figure 4C and S5. Also, as requested by all the referees, we have now provided data on the RNase-L genotype for the R462Q variant that had originally been associated with susceptibility to XMRV in prostate cancer. In CFS, we found no correlation between XMRV infection and the R462Q variant. As reviewer number 1 pointed out, this result makes it more likely the general population is at risk for infection. What would they say? Would they accept it or ask for further revisions? Imagining they were in a fairly private dialogue with science, nobody in the team could have predicted the bombshell that came next.